friends, thank you for tuning in to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren, and we are coming to you from the west coast of Sverige. Every Thursday and Sunday, we have a new program available for you at redicecreations.com. And this is our Sunday program, and we're almost halfway through August already. Wow, it's amazing how time do fly by, as it were. And today, back on the show, finally, we have our regular guest Alan Watt from CuttingThroughTheMatrix.com with us on the line. And we are going to spend some time today talking about a few interesting documents and future studies about institutes and predictive programming and other agencies that are involved in trying to predict the future for us and leading it accordingly that way. So let's say hi to Alan. Welcome back to the program, my friend. Nice to have you with us again.
Yeah, it's nice to have a phone that works now and be able to talk to you.
Exactly, that's right. You got your phone fried last time during a thunderstorm, and you just mentioned that you had continuing storms up in Canada. Is it like locally up there? Is it like in the entire area? What's going on?
Well, they were spraying here heavily during the day. You watch them spraying and making the cloud. You end up with this big mush. Then it builds up the heat because this covering of metallic particles acts like mirrors, and it just mirrors the reflections back and forth, and it causes the warming, which they're blaming us for in global warming. And then at night you have lots of thunderstorms, very odd thunderstorms. I sat around last week watching outside till about 2 or 3 in the morning, because I've never seen thunderstorms like it. There was no sound to the thunder, but you could see the lightning all around you, and it was continuous. And this is a new type of superheating of the atmosphere through the HARP technology in conjunction with the spraying of the skies. They're actually superheating the atmosphere and causing this new phenomena, this new type of lightning we've got. But it fries the telephone line sometimes.
Sheesh. So you got your house or where you're living at, your apartment, got directly hit?
I had a series of it's almost like lightning balls that you see, big balls of lightning round about you, but not high up. And I had a circle around the house. This isn't the first time. I had it before, a circle around the house, and it. I was holding the phone at the time, and it melted in my hand.
Really?
And,
is that true?
Wow. And the following morning, every electric part on my truck was fried as well.
Really?
So that's 3 times it's happened so far.
Sheesh, oh my God. Wow, talk about weird weather. I read a report, even if it's true or exaggerated, I don't know, but it was about overall so far in 2007, and it seems to be, globally, we have very weird weather. It's tremendous droughts in some areas and flooding. Of course, the UK and southern parts of Sweden had very severe flooding just a about a month ago, I think. And up here, it's been like the worst summer yet. It's been raining all the time, good summer weather, as it were, at all. And it seems to be spreading globally, and it seems to be very kind of, fitting according to with the agenda of changing weather patterns and the climate change and all of this. And, of course, as you say, there is the speculation about that this is not natural in that sense, but this is actually implemented from above, and this is weather manipulation in order to, drive us further into the belief that this is man-made global warming and it's all our fault.
Yes, there's a club, the Club of Rome. The Club of Rome is one of the top global think tanks that works for the global elite. And they put a book out in the 1970s called The First Global Revolution. And it was written by the two founders of the think tank. In there, and these were the guys who also gave us all the terminology to do with global warming. But in that book, they said in the book, and people should really get a copy, you can get second-hand copies for about 75 cents. On paperback, they say that they sat round thinking of ways to unite the world and to get the people to give up their rights and be managed by the expert society. And they discussed all possibilities. Could they use a space alien invasion theory and terrify the public? We have a common enemy to unite the planet. And eventually the guy says, we hit upon the idea of causing climatic changes.
Yeah.
And of course he meant by using sciences. And then convincing the public that they were causing the problem so that mankind would see himself as the actual enemy of the world. And
wow.
So that's in their own publication, their own book called The First Global Revolution, put out and published by the Club of Rome. And that's the top think tank for world strategy on the global level. And they give their ideas out to the other think tanks that then must implement it and market it into our minds through the media.
That's right.
So that's from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, and it's, as you say, it's all about that, that implementation and that there actually are, again, that there are agencies out there, you know, worrying, or, you know, worrying, but they are planning and you know, for our future and for the scenario of the future. And I see this myself very, very clearly now, at this point at least, that the idea of global warming is a way to implement a world government, because it's, again, talk about a global problem, you know, it's like we have to have a, you know, a centralized power structure in order to combat this, and we have to, you know, maintain the idea that, that humans are the ones to blame for it, and this is the way to do it, I guess. I mean, I think that the Al Gore thing now, 2007, also was, you know, very convenient, and it seems to be implementing or starting up, really hitting hard now, and as far as I've read, the continuous reports they're stating so far, however they can know this, but they say that we're going to continue to have more and more severe weather, you know, in the years ahead. So, yeah, that's right.
Yes. You know, the Al Gore's family, the Gore family, were trained and financed into being by Armand Hammer. And Armand Hammer was an interesting man because he was a globalist too. And although he was born in the U.S., and his father gave him the name, changed the name to Arm and Hammer for the Soviet flag.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's the, and he owns a big food companies today. But he was given an office next to Lenin and then Stalin, old Arm and Hammer.
Okay.
And then he had another office in New York. So he was running both sides on behalf of the world globalists. And he trained the Gore family to also take up the agenda and go on. All these guys are connected, you see.
So, I mean, there's, as far as I see it, there's like silly talk that Al Gore will kind of jump in on the Democrat side and continue to run for president. But at this point, I kind of see him as the, almost the, as the, you know, new emperor of the world, almost, you know, the global, you know, the centralized power structure. When they're going to have a president, Al Gore is going to be the, you know, at this point at least, the top guy for that one. I don't know if they're going to set up a big institution.
All they're doing is finding a job for him, because the guy cannot read very well, even his own script. Even when he was running in the U.S., for candidacy, he kept making mistakes, tremendous mistakes, and he was very laughable. But they always find jobs for the boys, as it were.
Sure.
And he was picked for this job. He won't be the final one.
No, of
course.
But
all he has to do is read his script anyway that's written by the others for him.
Sure, exactly. Now, that's interesting. It seems like a lot of these guys have the word, you know, the word, trouble with the words and reading, you know, same way as Bush. I don't know if it's... dyslexia or disease going around or something like that up there. But
it's also all the drugs they take, you know, and snorting your cocaine and stuff. And
yeah, that
they're
could
all
be
into that at the top.
Sure, that could be it, actually, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I saw, I was looking at your website, and you have a have a document up on your website right now called... a UK Department of Defence document, is it? And it's titled Development Concepts and Doctrine Centre Global Strategic Trends Programme 2007 to 2036. And I find this kind of, this is about again, future studies, as we mentioned, find this very interesting, and especially if it comes from a defense department or some kind of military or government institution. It's a 106-page long document, and I guess you have done a detailed analysis of it already, but maybe you could give us an outline. What is it about?
Well, it first broke into the public realm, the findings of this think tank. Now, this think tank is the premier or top think tank for the Department of Defense for Britain. But it's also the top think tank for basically NATO, all NATO countries. So the agenda that it foresees for the future is for a good part of the world. And now they go through a whole scenario of what's to happen in the near up to the future, to the year 2030, 31, around there. And all they foresee and predict is mob uprisings within the European and the Americas countries. But they don't tell us why there'd be uprisings amongst the people. And the uprisings that they're talking about, like flash mobs, and all these terms that they have now, where suddenly people will just form mobs and get very angry. They don't tell you why the mobs have become very angry. And they're talking about the everyday citizen in these countries. So whatever they... See, they know the agenda. They know that under the Kyoto, they're going to cut back all energy consumption to pre-1960s level, maybe even pre-1950s. They know the impact that's going to have on all of the public. They're also going to cut back on food supplies because under the UN Charter, they eventually are supposed to be in charge of all the world's food. And they are to distribute it to each country. And it'll be up to each country not to allow its population to go over a certain amount. If they do, you'll still get the same rations and you'll have to deal with the overpopulation problem. That's from the United Nations. So all of this is to kick in gradually, you see. And it's going to be population reduction. It's going to be energy reduction until, obviously, if they keep cutting back on oil or price it out of existence, a lot of people won't be able to even heat themselves in the cities. So you're looking at chaos ahead, and they know this because that's the agenda. It's the plan.
Yeah, exactly.
And they've been preparing to combat this, you see, and keep control over the Europeans and the Americans. So what they predict is that they'll have all this high-tech weaponry, which they have, both lethal and non-lethal weaponry. That's also technotronic weaponry, which can be fired through satellite and arrays of satellites. That's what the Star Wars program is really for. Or they can use it in conjunction with HARP. So there'll be forms of mind control to keep us all placid and calm or drugged almost. There's also the aerial spraying program because they have vast quantities. That was admitted by Rumsfeld of aerosolized Prozac and Valium and other drugs to spray over vast areas to calm the populace if there's another crisis. So I believe they're already doing that. And however, they're also willing to use neutron bombs on the public, which destroy all organic life. Or at least protoplasmic life, like humans. And leave all the infrastructure intact. And that's from the top think tank that works for Britain.
Oh, my God. You know, one thing right away that I can bring up here is there was a report not that many weeks ago. I think it was actually on Swedish television, if I remember correct. And this actually talked about because of the phasing out of the old fuel, meaning oil in this case, and that more and more were choosing, you know, ethanol as a new fuel. They mentioned that prices on some food actually will go up because this was a battle now between growing crops for ethanol fuel or for the food itself. And there has been a number of reports stating that, you know, prices will go up, or and you will have to basically we're put in front of this scenario that we have to choose between, you know, food and fuel, and whatever we're going to choose is going to be much more you know, expensive than before. And there were, had some lady on from the World Food Program, I think, talking about this, and they did comparisons, meaning that either the people in Africa are going to, you know, starve, or you'll have to drive your car for the same, you know, fuel, either made from ethanol, or, you know, she's going to have the, they are going to have the food to eat. So again, they're putting us in front of this scenario where we're causing this to each other, and they're creating this very, again, they're hitting like the, how should I put it, your, you know, they target your emotions, and they target your, that you should feel guilt in for, you know, what you're doing if you drive your car or whatever. And there's, and one thing that really strikes me is that, that there is never any mention of the real alternatives to energies, like the French air car that are developing now. They have, of course, motors running, as far as I know, on water. They had some guy in America a few years back that actually was murdered, that had a an engine that could run on water. And it's interesting that Al Gore and these guys, you know, talking about the environment and all of this, never bring up any new technological solutions to this problem. And that right there shows you, at least to me, that this is not the, you know, the real agenda that they're after here. There's something more, I guess, you know, they're
yeah. When I was small, I looked at the histories of engineering, especially to do with cars and vehicles. And I realized that really, regardless of how many outer styles they make of a car, an automobile, it's the same basic engine. Even with fuel injection, even then, with fuel injection had been tried in the early 1900s by military manufacturers.
Mm.
So there's nothing new in it. And I thought, you know, how come they'd never modified it? Until I read many years ago when I was young, I read a lot of the UN documentation. And to do with select areas to be used in the future for habitat areas, that's now published under Agenda 21 the 21st century, we've all to be moved into these overcrowded cities, which they'll call habitat areas. And then the population is gradually reduced. But there's to be no private motor vehicles allowed, according to the United Nations, in these habitat areas. So the plan is to phase out our ability to travel independently.
Yeah.
They said there'll be essential vehicles only, which is like police, military, etc.
Yeah.
In the future. So for all the reasons they're given us, it's nothing to do with any truth.
Yeah.
There's no shortage of oil at all.
Yeah.
In fact, I've got old school books from Canada with whole chapters on the oil findings in Canada, even Ontario here, of hundreds of wells which were found and capped, never to be used in the 1920s.
Mm.
I remember going over the North Sea often when I went across to Norway and Sweden, and I'd meet executives for British Petroleum and Dutch Oil and all the rest of them, and they'd talk to you on the ship, and these guys told me many times that they were finding so much oil that enough oil under the North Sea at that time to supply the world for a few hundred years just from there.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's nothing to do with shortages. It's the public, once again, that must be convinced to move into a new way of living, which is simply a form of more control. It's a way of living where you won't be able to decide anything for yourself, because we're all to be run by a world of experts.
Mm, yeah, that's right.
That's all it is.
Yeah. And we're going to be
a planned society. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And we're going to be in this mega cities, as you say, a few, I guess, you know, on the planet, very large cities. And, I mean, people are getting more and more sterile. So that's one thing. And then there could be an implementation of some kind of, you know, one child per family program that is, you know, in, like it's in China now. They're gonna, but I don't think they're gonna make it a law. They're probably gonna make something a hip thing that you choose, you know, so you don't get more than one child per family, and they're gonna implement it by some kind of fashion means propaganda or whatever, and people gonna want to have it that way anyway. So I guess they're, you know, either way you turn it, it's a win-win scenario. Do you know how many people, I've heard this before, that they want to have a population on the planet that is about, I guess, 500 million in total, something like that. That would mean at this point that 5.5 billion, you know, have to be, you know, eradicated, as it were. Do you know if this is a number, you know, that comes up now and again, or is it more or less than 500 million? Do you know?
What they're looking at here is a lot. These guys don't have final solutions. See, we always think in some big catastrophe. That's the normal human way.
Yeah.
We're dealing with families here who deal with history and the future intergenerationally, so they can plan to carry something out over 50 or 100, 200, or even 300 years.
Mm.
So they do foresee a time where they can convince and rear children to worship, in a sense, Mother Earth.
Mm.
And Mikhail Gorbachev talked about that in his own book called Towards a New Civilization.
Mm.
He said that, now he admits in the book that he himself is an atheist, but then he says, in the next chapter, he says, we, meaning this global elite, you see, that's his part, is to deal with this part of the strategy.
Sure.
He said, we are creating a new world religion, which is based and must be based on a form of earth worship.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they foresee a time, obviously, when they can rear children, indoctrinate them scientifically, which is already being done.
Mm.
And the children themselves will volunteer for sterilization to save Mother Earth.
Oh, my.
It will seem quite logical, and they'll probably give them certain public bonuses and certain privileges for doing so.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to be, yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. Okay, yeah.
Now, you're right with the figure. The 500 million it is the figure that keeps coming up now.
Mm-hmm.
Jacques Cousteau talks about it, the man who loved the fish and the animals, didn't like humans very much, especially the general public.
Mm.
And others have mentioned the same figures. Now, the World Wildlife Society is a big player in all this. The big foundations are big players in social agendas.
Mm.
And they all network together in their own specialized area. The World Wildlife Fund have at least three that they admit to. Three ARCs, they call them,
mm-hmm.
which are cryogenic laboratories, big, huge facilities. And the public broadcasting television in Canada did a documentary on one of them that's based in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a huge facility, big grounds and new buildings. And the professor, the lady that was in charge of it, is also a professor at the University of Louisiana
mm-hmm.
itself. And she showed around the facility. She says, we have pretty well every genotype, every gene type of every insect, plant, animal, and even humans
mm-hmm.
in this laboratory. She said, we have three worldwide. And not only do they have the genes there, they have done all the experimental processes to perfect test tubing them, if you like, and inserting them into any kind of donor. In other words, you could put a mountain lion, the sperm and the egg, fertilized,
mm.
into the womb of a dog or a cow or maybe even a human and bring it to a certain term and then bring it out by cesarean section,
yeah.
and it will be perfect. So everything has been tried and tested. And when she was asked the purpose of this, she said, well, if there's ever a global catastrophe, then we have three of these arcs worldwide
yeah.
where we can draw from and basically repopulate or reseed the planet.
That's right. And we have talked about this before, there's another facility in Svalbard up in Norway called Global Crop Diversity Trust. And this is actually a seed storage bank, basically, deep into a mountain up there. And I think it's it says a $37.5 million seed storage plan that will help safeguard crops vital for developing nations for global warming and other threats, the head of the UN-backed scheme said on Thursday. And interestingly enough, $300 million actually comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. How about that?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah, exactly.
And then again, I wouldn't be surprised if the space station, the International Space Station, if you speak the word, it's ISIS, International Space Station.
That's
ISS.
Right. Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's another major one in case of, not just of a catastrophe that got out of hand, something they start and can't control, but I think it'll be a planned, whatever happens will be planned, because the sciences they have, with unlimited financing from the taxpayer of the whole world, means they can draw on so many resources. They have advanced sciences that are kept quiet from the public, just like they've been spraying us for 10 years now, solid, from the skies on a global program. Then they also have these advanced sciences. All the stuff that you saw in Star Trek series from the 1960s didn't come out of the imagination of Gene Roddenberry. Every episode of Star Trek had an allegory of a reality which they knew they could produce. Because Gene Roddenberry was a member of NASA, which also is a big think tank for planning the scientific part of the future. NASA is not concerned about the exploration of space. That's for the public's benefit. NASA, its whole job is a military program, and most of their experiments in space and their satellites they're putting up were actually intended for now, the time coming up now, for total observation of the planet and for the Star Wars technology, where they can literally, in conjunction with HARP, they can literally fire different kinds of scalar weaponry at the planet itself.
Of course.
That's the real function of NASA.
Yeah, and I think basically when you get down to it, studying all of these different things that pop up, everything from underground bases to these vaults that they're setting up, gene banks, storages, whatever, even this in Svalbard is referred to as the Doomsday Vault. I mean, isn't that, telling you something right there?
And,
I think it basically is about they're going to terminate, as it were, this round, they're going to end off this particular time that we're on now, and basically they want to start anew. That's what I see in a way. They want to create some havoc on the surface.
You know, this was discussed 500 years ago. This phase that we're coming up to now, we're in, was discussed with the higher secret societies that emerged in the open 500 years ago. Under the different terms, and one of the terms being Rosicrucian, not the kind that you have today where you send away for their booklets, but the actual underground stream. What they meant by that is those who had collected the sciences down through the ages and kept them secret from the populace. And you'll find even in the quatrains. The quatrains of Nostradamus is meant for those who understand. That's why the exoteric is very interesting. The exoteric captures the minds of the general public, but that's only the outer shell to confuse you. But the esoteric understandings of the quatrains is a coded version. And when you understand the codes, you understand that they were planning a future even then.
Yeah.
And so you find that Nostradamus talked about this particular era. And he said that an angel from the east, now this could be missile whatever, because these guys were no dummies. These guys were experts in sciences. And they had knowledges accumulated for thousands of years. And he said it would come from the east and ignite the sky. And those who would survive would be, apart from some deep underground or inside mountains, this falls right in with Francis Bacon's New Atlantis, where he talks about the Americas, where they'd live inside mountains and deep underground. Nostradamus talks about the mansion in the sky, the house in the sky, where the elite would live.
Really?
We'll look down on this as it happens.
Yeah.
Jeez. And that's the space station.
Yeah. My God. Or bases on the moon or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. So, I mean, yeah, exactly. And it seems to be, if this is another form of, you know, as you say, Earth worship in that sense that is going in, it seems to be a strive for almost creating a new, again, you know, a new Garden of Eden where, you know, the planet is, you know, reborn again, fresh, and all the pestilence of the old humans are gone, you know, the kind of that type of scenario.
From the most ancient times, the high secret societies have always said, even to the present day, that their job is to perfect all that was left imperfect.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about plants, animals, the earth itself, and especially humans.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that's the Genesis project you're talking about.
Exactly, yeah.
And that's why they had that in the Star Trek, the Genesis the starting anew.
Mm.
And they used to couch it in different terminology. Again, 500 years ago, they called it the underground stream, those who had the knowledge of the flow of knowledge for thousands of years, knowing that no one else planned the future, and therefore whatever they planned and could work together intergenerationally for, they could actually accomplish. And that's true. If no one else is planning a future, those who are planning it and who take over the money supply and probably give you the money supply to begin with, can always pull off what they plan because no one else is planning.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. I mean, and that's also why many people have difficulty realizing that there actually are people planning for the future, because they themselves are often so busy, so stressed, you know, worried about, you know, very mundane things, as it were, important to some degree, but mundane yet, you know, paying the bills, you know, all the day-to-day chores, basically.
Yeah.
But up there on the top, you know, you have servants walking around handling all the domestic stuff for them, and these guys can sit around plan for, you know, future generations or whatever. It's like it's a totally different, you know, scenario, and it's a totally different way of living a life, and I think that people have to get that first, you know, into their head, their idea that all people don't live the way that they do, and all people don't think the way that they do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what about,
you look back even to 200 years ago, 250, 300 years ago, in Europe, especially in Britain, you had a feudal society with a feudal system where the peasantry were given, the only education they had was from the church. That's all they knew about what they thought was reality.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Rothschilds, Lord Rothschild, introduced a bill into Parliament, and it was called the Corn Laws.
Mm-hmm.
An idea was that for the first time, he and others would bring in to Britain huge quantities of crops in order to get all the small peasant farmers off the land and into the cities, because they needed to get people in to work in industry that was just taking off then at that time. And that was the first creation of the planned habitat, these awful cities, where they were crowded in like ants together, and they worked 16 hours a day.
Yeah.
Well, this is a continuation with habitat areas using similar means to get us all off the roads, out of the rural areas, into the big cities. It's the same ongoing agenda, planned and put forward and financed by the same families that were doing it, say, 300 years ago. It's quite easy to plan a future when you have everyone living and trained to live on this odd, strange thing called money. And we're trained at school to just go out and work and collect money.
Yeah.
Not food, not friends, not it, just money.
Yeah.
And who runs the money? So we all accept money because we're indoctrinated. It's the only system they have given us, in fact.
Yeah.
And because of that, it's the only system that we know.
That's right.
And we forget the people at one time lived without money.
Yeah.
A long, long time ago, and they were much happier for it.
Yeah,
definitely. Much more humane.
Yeah, definitely.
So these guys with money knew even thousands of years ago, especially from about 800 BC when they brought in coin.
Mm-hmm.
They knew that they could, by selective breeding, keep the power and and the money's intact. In fact, the money would grow as the married others with money and interbreed. They knew that they could plan any kind of future for thousands of years in the future and train their children to take over and have institutions even then working. Today we call them think tanks and foundations, but we'd have these foundations working towards their agenda generation by generation by generation, and therefore nothing could be impossible. Nothing.
Wow. And there it is, the system, that is the beast, you know. Again, we get kind of desensitized to the idea because we're so accustomed to it and it has been a part of us the entire life, but many people, you know, seldomly actually take that time to get the perspective, to actually think about what the money is and what is doing to our, you know, civilization and humanity as a whole, you know.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It's, as you say, it's a beast, and the system is a self-perpetuating, self-sustaining organism that is taken over and just, you know, running, and in some instances even, I think even institutions they become self, the interest is about keeping the institutions going in order for the people in there to actually have a work or something to do, to have the income. It's so many of these facets that are connecting here, and much of the root of this problem, as you say, I think also actually does tie us back to the fact of money. You're right there, yeah.
It's all that. See, money in old Hebrew and Aramaic used to mean men. You counted. You got up on a box and you counted the heads of people, and those were your slaves. And so money, it comes from money,
yeah.
From man, and that's all it is. It's a substitute for slavery. It's a more sophisticated form, as Charles Galton Darwin talked about.
Yeah,
and he had no problem with slavery. He said there has always existed in this system. He meant civilization, meaning money.
Mm.
Slavery in one form or of another, and he said we are simply introducing a new form of slavery, a more sophisticated form of slavery.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And they have done it.
They have. I actually saw this brilliant Star Trek episode, speaking of Star Trek, that actually was about a planet that where the equivalent of the Roman Empire never collapsed, and what they had did was that they... the Roman Empire basically expanded for 2,000 years more than here on Earth, and they've developed a system where actually they took slavery to the point where it was, you know, the slaves have benefit, they had a salary and all this, and basically it was all the things that we have today in that sense, that we have, you know, we have taken care of you in some sense, you have the basic little health care, you have somewhere to live, you know, but you have to pay the rent, and then you have the money, it's all, you know, it's and because with the amount of money that we actually can, save up, as it were, we can never, you know, do any major damage, you know, to the system. It's all just to sustain you at the moment, basically, and to get you through to the next day, basically. That's it, you know.
Yeah, the money is the first trick to steal real wealth, because real wealth is barter, and barter is between two people who exchange items of necessity, and they decide on how many sacks of this is worth so many sacks of that.
Mm-hmm.
Money came in as a substitute with a middleman, and once they convinced the two negotiators that this is just as good as that sack of oats, and you started to believe him, after a generation he starts dictating the purchasing power of that money.
Mm-hmm.
So you have no say in it. Now he now rules you, and because of that he can then take back your labor, and that's all it is.
Mm-hmm.
He takes back your labor because you earned so many hours in to get that coin or that paper note or whatever it is.
Mm.
And he takes it back in the form of taxation. When even Lenin and all those, and they worked for they were trained by the top bankers. The left wing was trained by the top bankers.
Yeah.
Because communism is a dialectic of capitalism.
That's
and so
yeah.
Lenin knew, and he said the same thing, that people who are taxed by the state for money, the state is simply taxing back so much of their labor that they spent that week earning the money. So it's a sophisticated form of slavery.
Mm, yeah.
Because you don't think of it as slavery.
Of course.
You're born into. If your parents don't know, they won't know to tell you. So you think it's quite natural that the government should take up to 50 or 60% of your earnings back.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, in most cases, all, you know, wishes and dreams are found within the material world nowadays, so people don't think of themselves as slaves because they have the opportunity to buy themselves the nice stuff, and everything is provided for you within the system and the structure itself, so people don't even think outside that box and take a look at what they're actually part of, because, you know, there's something to strive for within the system itself now, you know.
Yes, even though what they strive for, if they stop and think about it, they don't own any of it.
Yeah,
they think
right.
They do.
That's right, yeah.
But if you pay tax on your home, and if you do not pay your taxes, you'll find if you own that home or not very quickly.
Mm.
Because in comes the government and they steal your home.
Mm. Yeah.
They have different words for it, but stealing is still stealing, you see.
Yeah, exactly.
And they steal your home from you because you couldn't. Now, when the mafia ran New York and Chicago, the mafia would go around all the stores and they would say, give me some money for protection.
Mm.
And you would say, well, protection against whom?
Mm.
You say, from us.
Mm.
You see?
Yeah.
Or we'll burn your place down or kick you, kill you and take your property.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was called extortion. You see?
Yeah.
Now, when the government does it, it's called taxation.
Mm, exactly.
Or they'll reclaim or possess your home.
Yeah.
Different terminology to change the perception of the same event.
Mm.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that wonderful how they manage to turn it all around? And
well, you go, I get turtles here, big snapping turtles, and they go along the road and across the field.
Mm.
Huge things that sometimes are a meter long with a shell.
Mm-hmm.
And he carries his home on his back.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I try to pull that shell off that turtle, he's going to bite me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm going to try to take his home from him.
Sure.
So even the animals know, hey, you can't take that. This is nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the right by nature to have a roof over my head.
Mm-hmm.
We are the only creature that works our lives and we kill ourselves and have heart attacks trying to get a house.
Mm-hmm.
And then you pay all the taxes trying to keep the house. Each time they go up and up and up.
Yeah.
And so we never get the time to enjoy anything, really. And then when you die anyway, the government comes in and even takes it back from death duties.
Mm, yeah.
Because even when you're dead, you've got to pay taxes.
Mm, yeah.
And I talked to an agent in the federal government in Canada a while ago, and I was told quite candidly that they talk about it amongst themselves. It says everybody works for the government.
Mm.
We all work for the government.
Yeah.
All of us.
Hmm.
So we're all slaves. Yeah.
And it's as you said, that the natural laws of you know, nature or the universe or whatever is taken away from us, the right to sustain yourself in that sense. I mean, I don't know if there's any place left in the world where you actually can go out into the forests and actually, you know, build your own house and, you know, plant crops and stuff and grow your own food. There might be some places where they actually don't discover you or something like that, but if it's doable by law, I have no idea, but it feels like it's no place left on the planet now.
You'd have to be... there are a couple of places, but I won't tell them because they'll become crowded if I do.
That's right.
But I think for as far as Europe and the West goes, it's a matter of looking at the big, vast expanses where you can become nomadic. See, in ancient times, before we became an agricultural-based society, which was necessary for the money system, we used to be nomadic.
Yeah.
And we were like gypsies, a natural way. We travel with the seasons to different places. So did the American Indians.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd have a different camp in the summer. They'd move to another camp in the autumn, another one for the winter. And you go to the high grounds in the summer and the low grounds in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had all these. And that was a big adventure for the whole tribe.
Sure.
Fighting.
Sure.
And it's something natural about moving like that and settling and moving.
Mm-hmm.
And they call civilization the settling of us into these camps, you might say, of agriculture.
Mm, yeah.
And in came the money system to go with it, and the priesthoods to dominate your mind.
Mm, yeah.
And then the taking back of tithes or taxations from you.
Sure.
So you ended up working for the high priesthood at one time.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed.
That's right. And there's many other aspects to whites. Bad, or in most cases, you know, in speaking of agriculture, we have these monocultures and huge fields, and we plant on the same soil over and over again. But you know, to leave nature and to have its, you know, let nature run its course on its own areas, and actually moving around instead of exploiting one area and then moving to the next because it's depleted or whatever, you know, of nutrition. So it's,
yeah,
you know, it's so many things that is wrong with that way. But
that's right. Anyway. So we there are all. And that's what I mean, too, because when a child is born into a system and the parents haven't questioned it, the child will not question it either. He'll think it's quite natural. Everything that exists was going to be natural to him.
That's right.
And and that's what Lenin said. He said, Lenin said, there are 1,000 directions society could go in ways of living.
Mm.
And he said, but the public must not know this. They must be taught to believe that the one they're born into is the only natural one that could have evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how simple this is.
That's right.
There are so many ways we could live. However, all of those ways, those alternate ways, even being nomadic, for instance, or tribal, wandering, even that would destroy the control of the elitist system.
Mm.
And that's why that they've tried to eliminate all those loopholes to sustain yourself, because under the Charter of the United Nations, it says interdependence is the only way that will be allowed.
Mm.
Interdependence means there will be no independence.
Yeah, yeah.
Either between nations or between individuals. Everyone is to be interdependent on the system for all of their needs.
And speaking of that, I did want to bring up an article that I had up on redicecreations.com a few weeks ago. And the article is actually called Scientists on Acid, the story behind changing images of man. And it was picked up from a website called skilluminati.com. And the piece was about a document called Changing Images of Man from the Stanford Research Institute, a very interesting article. Changing Images of Man was an attempt to identify and assess the plausibility of a truly vast number of future possibilities for society. And it goes on to say, we next followed a method of analysis that determined which sequence of possible futures, that is, which alternate future histories, appear to be the most plausible in light of human history, and to most usefully serve the needs of policy research and development. And in this article, it also stated that the funding for this SRI project was provided by something called the Charles F. Kettering Foundation, and they also found a very similar project that was called the Alternative Futures Project. And this was headquartered, I think, at the University of Illinois. And the guys involved in this project was Charles Osgood and Stuart Umpleby, and they wrote a report that was entitled A Computer-Based Exploration of Alternative Futures for Mankind 2000. And the report was included in something called Mankind 2000. That was a book. And there was one very interesting paragraph from this report that I want to read here. And it says like this: in the organization of civilization of the future, we anticipate that the individualistically oriented man will become an anachronism. Indeed, he will be viewed as a threat to the group organization as well as to his fellow man. Hence, as stated, he in all likelihood will have few individual expectations. While such a picture may not be pleasant to contemplate, when viewed with our present orientation and value judgment, we would be amiss to deal with unrealistic imagery that would blind us to the future reality. So there you have it. If this is the idea of what the future will be, I'll bet that the people who pay for these studies and make sure that they are, you know, that they're done, these studies, they're going to make strategic planning towards this kind of scenario of the future.
Yeah, that was the whole idea that we're going towards with the brain chip. Because at the major meetings they had at Loyola University, the world meetings, and this was sponsored by the U.S. Department of Commerce,
mm-hmm.
they said that the brain chip is ready to go, and once this is inserted, there'll be no such thing as individuality.
Yeah, exactly.
It'll be more like the hive, that's what he said.
Yeah.
But it'll be impossible for an individual to even perceive of themselves as a distinct, separate individual.
Yeah.
And they've always had this goal, because when they had the big discussions and debates of the beginning of Marxism, which was born, remember, in London, and sponsored and paid for in London,
mm-hmm.
They said that the end product will be the end of individuality.
Mm, yeah.
That was their goal.
Exactly. And exactly, the individual-oriented man will become an anachronism, and as it's said there, he will also become a threat eventually, meaning that if you're a person that, you know, don't want to join the hive, if you don't want to, you know, be in the collectivism, whatever it might be, whatever ism it might be that you don't want to join, you're going to be viewed as a threat. You're going to either be, you know, hunted down or taken care of, or people will, you know, freeze you out totally, so you become a, you know, hermit in any way. So it's this.
Yes, they had that.
You know,
they had that in Star Trek too. You know.
Mm-hmm.
In the early series, when they land on a planet and everyone has a brain chip in them,
mm-hmm.
and they all say, "Are you off the body?" was their expression as they greeted each other.
Okay.
And then eventually they found out it's a supercomputer that had run this planet for thousands of years, keeping the society as it was, and it literally controlled everybody's mind. So they understood this whole agenda when they wrote Star Trek. As I say, Roddenberry was a member of NASA. He knew the agenda, and he was told to write it into an exciting story
mm-hmm.
so that we become familiar with the idea, and that's called predictive programming.
You know,
it actually comes into existence, we accept it as a natural progression.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting actually that you mentioned that episode, because I think I actually saw that episode last night, if I remember correctly. I think it was called The Apple. I can link it up to the program info page in case people want to look at it. It was available on YouTube, and you're right, it was a very interesting episode, so take a look at that, yeah.
So they know the agenda. Mm-hmm. All these science fiction writers either take their orders from NASA,
mm-hmm.
because NASA says, we want the public to do this in 50 years, so you program it through fiction into an exciting way in story form and get them used to the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the other big group is the Futurist Think Tank, the Futurist Society.
Mm-hmm.
All the major authors of science fiction go there, and they're given grants to write stories around particular topics which they're told to write about. So everything is organized in this system.
Mm-hmm.
To control our minds, to prepare our minds for what we think of as inevitable,
mm-hmm.
so that we accept it calmly when it actually comes into being.
Mm-hmm.
And that's predictive programming. Yeah.
And I think the solution here to this kind of problem that we're facing is to remain strong as an individual, to follow your own line, do your own thinking, and not, you know, care about whatever the hive or the herd is up to or is doing. I mean, they could go rampant on their own, and as long as there is some place where you actually can live that is with outside, you know, either if it's a huge city, you know, where they have you know, either we have to have a chip to be in there, or if it's some other external thing electromagnetically or something that is happening. But as long as at least we can, you know, there is a possibility to live on the countryside or a wee bit outside and do your own thinking and develop your own and live your own life and follow your own trends, I think that is the best solution to it all. And as long as people, you know, want to be in that kind of group mentality or hive or whatever, And if they have that sensor, that background, or even if they're programmed into doing it, I think that when people are ready to turn away from that or to develop their own individuality, or when something happens to them that actually makes them to awaken, I think they'll be ready to move out from that. But until that time, I don't see it as, in a way, to be our job to try to break these people from that mold. It feels like many of these people, as I said, kind of want to be in that scenario as it is now.
A lot of people, and they've done all the studies on it, to see how effective. Now, 80% of the public are hypnotics, and Aldous Huxley talked about this in a speech he gave at Berkeley back in the 1960s. And that was from Tavistock Institute, so these were accurate figures that they'd done surveys over many years and found it to be consistent. 80% of the public are instantly hypnotizable, meaning at all times they are suggestible. So they never question the reality as it's been presented to them from birth. 20% more need more work, maybe twice as long, to prepare them to be hypnotized, which only leaves 20% in any generation who cannot be hypnotized. So the target of the elite have always been the individuals within that 20%. Now, within that 20% of more aware people, you'll find some who commit suicide in the young because they can't fit into the society. They don't have the knowledge to realize, no, they're not failures. It's the system that's rigged. It's all phony. And so there's only a small percentage comes through into adult life and acquires the knowledge of wisdom of what's really going on. And that's the group that they decided hundreds of years ago would be their major problem at this crucial time. And that's why they're going after the individuality. They said that China, being the model state for the world, they'll use those techniques of either social approval or social disapproval to alienate that small percentage of individualistic-minded people. Now, in China, that's what they use for a woman who's now pregnant with a second child. They don't have to bring the militia or the police now to take her to the abortion clinic. They've got the public so conditioned. The neighbors, when they notice, will drag her to the abortion clinic. That's called the creation of instilled social disapproval, the Pavlovian technique that works with most people.
That's right. The self-policing, they don't even need, as you say, a force to implement that because it's self-sustaining. Oh my God.
Therefore, the same technique will be brought in with those individuals who will not succumb. The 80% in society who live in a world of hypnosis and suggestibility, and their ideas are marketed right into their brains, they will shun the individual. They'll be taught to shun the individual.
Of course.
Just like religious groups would do with people who didn't want to continue with them.
Yeah, exactly. Be a part of that. We are going to continue with our second hour with Alan Watt for our subscribers, and we are going to talk about television, pharmaceuticals, vaccines, sacrifice, population control, and the acclimatization of the culture of death, among other things. Check out our subscriber section on redicecreations.com if you want to find out more on how to get full access to our radio archive. Before we finish off this segment, I also want to mention Alan's websites: CuttingThroughTheMatrix.com and AlanWattSentinelSentinel.eu. Articles, audio blurbs, books, and DVDs are up there for you to check out. Thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren for handling the audio, and thanks to you for tuning in. We will be back on Thursday. Until then, take good care. The website is RedIceCreations.com. Tune you.